Good evening, everyone. I'm Jed.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Tom.
And welcome to Bane Chat.
Yeah, welcome everyone to our very special Christmas episode. And it's special because we normally do this online through Discord, but today we're all in the same room. We're all in Jed's dining room. It's very exciting.
Absolutely. I mean, that sounds very romantic.
I think it is romantic in its own way. I've been looking forward to this for weeks, you know.
We've got the Christmas decorations up.
It's lovely, isn't
it? Mood lighting.
Yeah. The online recording works well for us, but yeah, we all live what, like 20 minutes away. We don't see each other enough, really. So this has been nice. But yeah, so I guess the audio might be taking a little bit of a hit on the quality here. But you know, just bear with us. Really, it's going to be a bit of a special Christmas episode. Tis the season. Cut us some slack.
If the audio quality is the single selling point we've got, we're doing it wrong already, right? It'll be fine.
And also, in fairness, my wife has done the Lord's work in terms of setting us up a little podcasting station in my dining room. So
shout out Grace. Yeah, this is amazing. We very professional.
Excellent. So, are we? We've got a vague plan, mm-hmm. but we've also got alcoholic drinks. But we've got a vague plan for now, which is that we're gonna talk a little bit about what's happened in our year of 2025 on the Kings of War table and in the Kings of War hobby for a little bit. A little bit of a farewell, because obviously we know that 4th is on its way. So how we found 3rd edition or 3.5 overall, and what we did with it this year, what we liked, what we didn't like. And then we're going to move on to have a little bit of a chat about 4th. We know it's been covered a lot, so it's only going to be a short chat about 4th. See what we're looking forward to. And then after that, I think we're going to just probably kick back and talk about Christmas.
I'm a big fan of Christmas. I never used to be. Last few years, got really into Christmas.
I'm really glad that we are all fans of Christmas, because it'd be really awkward if one of us just wasn't.
Yeah, I've been
always into Christmas.
I've always been into Christmas.
Yeah.
You've always hosted Christmas here, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah.
Friend Christmas, yeah.
It's been my thing.
Yeah, well, this is lovely then.
Not everybody likes Christmas, do they?
No, they don't. Just saying. It's still a King of War podcast. If you like Christmas, you're welcome to stick around, you know.
Absolutely.
Maybe your heart will grow 3 times as big by the end.
All holidays are welcome. So in terms of the categories of things that we're going to look over, we've done some brief notes, but also we're hoping that this will be a bit more sort of conversational. But as Glenn put it earlier, we're looking for this to be a farewell to 3rd edition. And we're going to sort of look back on some of the things that we've enjoyed over the last couple of years. And one of the first things that we had down on our list was best game, or perhaps possibly best opponent.
I was just going to start in January the 1st and go from there. Is that what we're doing?
Well, I don't think I've played enough this year to... I think that obviously our extensive back catalogue of 2 episodes means this can't be a podcast year in review.
No.
And actually, I'm going to shout out some of the best games that I've had this year, because they've mostly been with one opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a person who, if you were to see him by his interactions on Fanatics alone, you would think he was the most miserable man alive. But the best games I've had in Kings of War have been against Rich Miles. We've played, I think, 3 times, and I think it's currently 2-1 to me.
Nice. He's a solid player.
Yeah, he's a good player, great player. And also sort of real sort of stalwart of the Kings of War community in the North. It goes to lots of events. It's always a great game when you play Rich. But the sort of distinct memory I have with him is he's not just a tactical general when it comes to playing Kings of War. Like he plays the wider game. It's not just about sort of list development and things like that. And that was mostly on show when I played him after going to a gig in Manchester the night before I attended a tournament. And he deliberately made me choose the side of the board in full blazing sun next to a radiator. And I think that might be the catalyst for his win against me out of the 3 games that we played. So my best games of 3rd edition have been against Rich Miles. It is amazing though how often that decision is solely based on comfort.
Yes, oh for sure, yeah. You see, like, the guy behind them is like pushing his chair all the way out. You've got no personal space over there, mate. Over you go.
Sorry, I've just been quiet there because I realised as soon as Jed started naming opponents that I had to remember what my opponents were called. So I've just been looking through the results from Clash 2025, like, who did I... Oh, it doesn't tell me.
No.
But I think favourite game, it definitely goes to a shout-out. I'm going to say, I've not been able to find name, but is it Richard Luke?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I drew him in round 1 of Clash this year. And of the Clash House team that went down there, I got apparently the hardest draw of it. Like, I didn't know Rich before this, but he was apparently a very skillful player, and he had a list that was in playstyle, did exactly what mine does, but a lot better. Mm-hmm. So it was always going to be a challenging game.
What was he playing? What were you playing?
So he was playing ogres, and it was a very, very meaty ogre list. And Grok was in there. In fact, I think Grok and Nom featured in there.
Yeah,
classic.
So basically, it had a lot of defense five stuff with piles of attacks and crush, and it was faster than me. I had the same idea in that my Riftforged were defense five, piles of attacks and crush, but his infantry was faster than mine. It was balanced by my Hellstrikers, which were faster than him. But when I got to the table, it was on one of the two tables that were like physically raised higher than the rest of them,
mm-hmm.
to which it obviously came up in conversation. And it turned out that like a few months before, he'd fallen down the stairs and broken his back.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. So this is why he was stood up all weekend, because he couldn't sit down.
Sheesh. God, he's not against them, man. God, he's not against them.
And that's how I won.
The amount of people, though, who I spoke to that weekend and said, why are all war game tables not this height?
Exactly, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
But no, we both sort of launched ourselves into that game. We were both hyper because it was the first round, and we were both dead excited about it. And we just had a cracking game. Like, everything about it was great. And you know, when you just see eye to eye with your opponent from the get-go, it was brilliant. So, like, he was a great opponent. And the result of the game, it was a tight-fought game. I did just about sneak it.
Nice.
But that's not the point. Like, the point is, it was the best opener for the best weekend of the year that I could have hoped for.
100%. Because, like, I think there's something to be said, because Clash let you pick a grudge match, don't they?
Yes.
And I haven't done that. I've not done that the last 2 years. And I feel like I should, just so you know, you can pick someone cool and your weekend is getting off to a great start. Because I think that's a lot of the nerves with Clash, especially about any weekender. You're like, what if my first opponent is not great? Because it's rare in Kings, but, you know, Kings players are humans and some humans are not great. Like,
I'm going to say I've never had a not great opponent.
I've definitely had games I didn't enjoy. Like, no, you know. What was your worst game of 2025? Call them all out.
They were all in Glenn's house. the other side of things as well is that a bad game isn't necessarily a bad opponent. Like, it can just be an unfun list or a combination of list scenario in your list and those sorts of things.
I find you can often laugh your way through those.
Yeah,
again, the thing is, it's not always like a bad opponent, but some opponents don't really give you a lot back, if you know what I mean. Some people aren't always there for the jokes and smiles, and when you're like, this game's tough for me and you're not making it any easier, that can be a rough one.
I know what you mean.
So yeah, sorry, you were saying about picking grudge matches at Clash, and yeah, I did do it 1 year, because 1 year I played against Todd Durkin, who is the cool... Do we know Todd?
I've met him a few times, yeah.
Coolest guy.
I think I gave him a phoenix at Clash this year to use in his terrain.
Terrain?
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
But anyway, I played him 1 year as a grudge match, because we had a cracking game as the last game of Clash the year before, and we said, let's do a grudge next year. And so we did. And so I just knew I was going to have a great time on my first game, and I think I should have done that again this year. My first game was great this year too.
I do like the grudge match system. I did it the first year we went, not for a grudge, but Heather Armstead was there, and we've known each other online for about 5 years prior to that game, and we'd never met each other.
Nice.
And it was brilliant. It's the same thing. And I think that, I'll be honest, at the start, I didn't really like the grudge match thing, because I do like the randomness of not knowing your opponent before you get going. But then I've seen a lot of good uses for it, such as that. So, yeah.
I think without getting sort of too derailed on this, because this is a subject that I love the sound of my own voice on, a grudge match should either be an opportunity to play someone who you enjoy playing and don't get the opportunity, or a punch-up. There's nothing more I find sort of embarrassing than someone who's a very competent player offering a grudge match out in the expectation of an easy first round win. Doesn't happen a lot.
The absolute worst.
Does that happen?
I've heard of it anecdotally.
You've probably heard it anecdotally from me. Frankly.
Well, no, it's the sort of thing. And you know there are people who would do that, right?
Yeah. But they might not even know they're doing it in truth.
No, sure.
But that's a thing.
My best game is also from Clash. Yours wasn't the Clash game, was it?
No.
So we're not all from Clash.
Energy. No, funnily enough, actually, I did play Richard Clash. Oh, it was one of the three games I've
so
played.
So what we're saying is that you should definitely go to Clash because you have all the best games there. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a close one, because I've had some really, really good games. In fact, all my games were great at Clash this year. But I played a guy called Alfred from Germany who's playing Trident Realms. And his army's gorgeous. He's got loads of like aquarium plants in it, all like brightly coloured, dead cool. So I was playing my Rakan. So it's like a really garish two armies up against each other, which was cool. And it was just, there was a huge forest in the middle of it, and it was one of the token collecting ones. And it was that sort of thing where he was like, oh gosh, I think he won the role for the first player or whatever it was, and just picked it totally wrong. And basically, at turn one, went, I just have to walk into your guns here, don't I? Like, I can either sit back and not have any tokens, because all my guns are range 12, yeah. So I can't shoot off on turn one. But he's like, oh, I just have to walk into this, don't I? I'm like, I'm really sorry, but you do. But he was just dead good sport about it. Really fun. But then he did a lot of good plays as well, so he got me on the back foot a lot of the time, and there was just this giant, like, about 18-inch by 18-inch forest in the middle of the board. And it was like, who dares to stand in the forest knowing that they're definitely going to get killed by the opponent? It's just, yeah, fantastic. But it was just like, just like laughing through the whole game, you know, you get a snake and you're both like, ah, just like quality opponent. And then it was one of these things, there was a weird rules thing where I think one of his like characters had picked up a loot token right at the start, but he'd not actually put it on the model. And then he'd run the model away. And I was like, I don't know why he's running away, but sure. And he was like, I'm running away with a loot token. And then we realized we sort of did a count of loot tokens and it was like, oh no. Because I'd been fighting for this one that was still on the table. It's called a judge over. But it was just that thing where, in a lot of games, I think that would be a really tense kind of who's right, who's wrong, what's gone on. Whereas we were like, you know what? Who cares? We just want to keep this game rolling because we're having a great time. We'll get a judge over, they'll pick one. Neither of us care which way it goes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, just
it's cool. It's the way to go, isn't it? I think if you can get on a level with your opponent.
Yeah.
And you both realise what you're after from the game, which generally is a laugh at a good time. Then you've got a recipe for a good experience.
I think that's it, because it sounds to me from what you're both talking about is that your favourite games have been essentially collaborative games almost.
Yeah.
Like you're both playing an equal part in the experience rather than one person doing a game at someone else.
100%. Also, that's not to say they were like beer and pretzels games. They were both solid opponents, both hard fought games, came down to the wire for the win. But just, it was like that high level of, we're here to have fun. We both want to win this and we're trying to outwit each other, and that's part of the fun. But overall, we're not falling out about stupid stuff. We're just...
Yeah, me and Rich Luke coined the phrase a good glance. So it was because of the way our armies worked, we were just rolling buckets of dice at each other. Every combat was 18 plus attack, so it was just buckets of dice. So one player would roll a load of dice and then you would be the first glance of, oh no, I can see like 15 ones in there. And then when you pick all your ones out, you're also like, yes, but I've got 24 hits as well.
Sure, so yes.
Like, we were starting to weigh up each other's dice in terms of, is it a good glance? Is it a bad glance? What's the first glance say?
Yeah, that's just really nice. Like, that's it. When you know you've got those in-jokes going on with your opponent, like, you're like, okay, we're in.
We're on a level.
I think to move on to the next thing on our crib sheet we have is best army that you saw. And again, I'm going to extend this if you wish past 2025, but if you want to limit it to 2025, you're welcome to do so.
There's a lot, isn't there? This is my worry.
And I also just want to clarify as well, we're using best army in the sort of conventional sense of it can be best painted, best modelling, best illuminated, whatever you think is particularly appropriate.
Yeah, we're talking visuals here.
Yeah. The overall piece.
Can I give you like a top 15?
Yeah, well, like it's the season.
You haven't done that many armies.
It's the season, man. Let's be generous. Have as many as you want.
Okay, yeah. Maybe. There's three that I want to shout out. They're not all from this year though, but I think that Paul Welsh, he did his Night Stalkers 2023. This is one.
Oh, I remember them, and they're some of the one like a sort of bridge. And stuff.
Yeah, yeah, cool. And they were just. They're one of the highest quality Kings of War armies I've ever seen. Yeah.
It's really crisp, isn't it? It's
incredibly crisp. Yeah. So yeah, we have to shout out Paul because he's a brilliant painter. So that will be. In fact, it's not a countdown top three.
Mm-hmm. All round community nice three. Guy as well, actually.
Yeah absolutely. Yeah. The next one is Chris Christopherson's Bazillions.
I was going to say them.
Sorry,
I don't think I know which army this is.
It's a really I don't like the phrase, but it's a really grim, dark looking.
I think
Crusader.
They're like Dark Souls based. I'm not familiar with those sorts of games, but he told me it was based on like Dark Souls or one of those type games. Yeah.
What I can, and I've never played Chris, but what I can remember looking at is just a legion of sad-looking people with terrible things happening to them.
Yeah.
How did I not notice this?
I don't know.
It's right up my street. It is,
it's a bit darker than you. It's not. Yeah, it's less grimy and more sinister, I think, than what you go for.
Yeah, but I remember there's one guy in particular who's like just sort of sat down with his head in his hands. because it's one of those like one of those armies that you can just look at, and every unit has something that makes you go, what's happening to him? What's going on there?
He has chariot. I think they're chariot regiments, but it's just one big chariot. But it's just this giant, weird, spiked death machine, and that's super cool.
Strange.
And like his phoenixes are humans on these big sort of ruins. Well, not humans, like angels. Yeah. Really cool.
And number three is also Chris. This is where I've got to get the right way around. Chris Walsh. Got it. He did. Are they technically
salamanders? I think is the one you're thinking of.
The one that's a hybrid of all the mantic kits ever.
Oh yeah, it's all like heavily green stuff.
First of all, it's brilliant. But also, just shout out to Chris because he's a lovely, lovely man.
Nice.
I met him properly on one of the painting day things as the prize for coming to the painting awards. And we just get on really well, and he's a lovely, lovely man, and he's very, very talented. So there you go. That's my top three.
Lovely.
I've already taken the top three now. Sorry.
No.
I don't think you have three.
So I've got a couple. I think for one, Heather's Pirate Salamanders.
Good shout.
Really cool.
Really good.
Did Pirate Ogres last year or for a few years, and this year pivoted to Pirate Salamanders. Girl knows what she likes.
Typecast.
Yeah, but they're just really cool. And again, it's that sort of thing where you look at it and you look at it and you go, oh, that's a really cool pirate army. And then the more you look at each unit, you go, oh, that's cool about that. Oh, that's cool about that.
She has got sideways grabs. We all know.
Sideways, yeah. Cool, super cool. What's nice as well, she has a parrot that used to represent a giant in her ogres, and that represents a phoenix. So now it can actually fly. So that's good. That's
love it.
But yeah, just really, really cool, like fun army, real fun. What was the other one I was going to say? Oh, Al, our good buddy Al, did a Trident Realms army that was all like 3D print Nurgle demons.
Alistair Vowles,
of course. It was super cool. And it was all, it wasn't in like, you see some Trident Realms army and they're in like 2 inches of resin, clear resin water, which was cool, but he didn't know. There was like about half an inch of resin on the bases and that. It just looked really smart. And he, being Al, what he always does is churns out an army in a weekend.
But, and a piece of shit at you with it.
Oh, he does. Yeah. Oh well, that goes without saying. No, actually, you know what? I played the army and I won.
I've never known someone go, I'm going to do this quickly, and you're like, why has this taken you 5 hours to paint?
Yes.
It looks so good.
It did look so good.
Because I think he's just got that sort of skill of going, here's the unified look.
Yeah.
Like, it looks great as a whole, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was really lovely. One thing about that game I played, it was because Alistair's a phenomenal player, really, really strong, and he was a bit up. I think I had a couple of breaks of good luck, a couple of things being just out by half an inch or whatever, but I realised he'd left. I had a unit of tunnel runners way hiding back, and he'd left an individual just about in range to charge them where they'd hit it, break it, and then be on the side of one of his placoderm units. And it's the first time ever I've seen him properly make a mistake. You know, you sort of look in his eyes, I've not seen him before, he's like, oh shit. Yes! So that was
to becomes that.
My gaming highlight of the year, I'll take that. I don't even need to say it. What an opponent Alistair is. Like, so glad we got him in that group. Cool, cool guy. I think that's the two ones.
I think just to carry on from that, actually. Arguably the sort of catalyst for the Liverpool Kings of War scene, really.
For sure.
Because if it wasn't for him as being a sort of a regular opponent for me in the beginning, I wouldn't have stuck with the game and wouldn't have sort of got you guys involved. And he's probably the person I've played most.
Definitely is.
Yeah. Of course it is, yeah. It's not uncommon for us to be drawn round one at a tournament that we've spent 2 hours driving to as well.
Of course. The thing is, we'll get him on the podcast in the new year for sure. Like, once Fort's up and running, we're going to tournaments and stuff. We want to do some, like, you know, armies reviews, tournament reviews, that sort of thing. He's got the best knowledge of the game out of all of us, so we'll get him in for sure.
When we get to a point where we need to sort of convince you that we know anything about Kings of War,
or the proper crunch, we'll get Al involved.
Yeah.
My best army is a slightly sort of curveball because I don't think it's been particularly well seen, actually. So the person who painted this is Nick Williams, who everyone will know from having won the best army at Clash this year for his extensively converted and 3D sculpted... what was the army? It was Empire of Dust in the end, yeah. Wasn't it? But it was sort of like...
Was it like Rakkin, like Zombie Orcs, Resurrected by Rakkin?
Yeah.
I don't know how this army didn't come up sooner, actually, because that was... I mean, it won Best Army at Clash. It doesn't need us to say, oh yeah, that was really good, actually.
Yeah, and I think from what I understand, that was sort of Nick's last hurrah at Kings, for at least in the short term. Him and Paul are really, really cool guys. It'd be a shame for them to sort of leave permanently, but I understand they're sort of doing different things at the moment. But my favourite army that I saw was Nick's Orcs, that were mostly based on GW Orcs. And they came to my tournament in St. Helens about a year ago now, maybe a little bit less. Just remind you of these guys.
I don't think I've seen them. They are really cool.
You were at the tournament.
I must have not seen this somehow. Was it your first round of St. Helens?
No, it might have been actually.
I haven't seen this before.
Yeah. Honestly, it was one of those things that it seemed to be an army that he'd lovingly put together, and I don't know to what extent he's ever played it since, but it was lovely and just really hit a lot of boxes for me in terms of like model selection, very sort of good converting and top quality painting, which is what you expect from Nick. The galling thing actually about Nick winning Best Painter at Clash this year is him talking about how rubbish his painting was and that he was doing it in the hotel the night before.
Yes.
That's insane to think about it from that perspective, but there we are.
The Rakkin army was one that I saw at Clash, and it was a really cool display board. I think we talked about this on the last episode, and then I had to cut it for some reason. But he made this display board, and it was on about three levels. It was like a cube.
Yeah, I remember
and
saying.
It was a big like rat tunnel, and it had this...
Did you not see this, Jeff?
I did see it.
Yeah, it had the firefight tunnelers. But he mashed two of them together with a like vacuum tube in the middle, so the whole like that thing was crawling up the whole thing. Oh, it was... phenomenal. So
yeah, that was
gorgeous. Like,
that was a good thing. I mean, some of these projects are, and again, we're sort of wandering into the territory of being a bit more sort of grand about this than it sort of needs to be, but sometimes it's just the idea behind it that's so 100%. Impressive more than the sort of the execution of it, or as much the execution as it is the idea.
Yeah.
Okay, so next on the list, and I'll take this one first, is favorite paint job you did. I think that my army for Clash this year was deliberately my sort of high effort project. I've always historically painted with what sometimes gets called contrast plus, which is essentially sort of contrast plus highlights.
Yeah.
Whereas this time it was a bit more sort of traditional in terms of its sort of painting approach. And my Kings of Men this year with the display board and the sort of church and all that kind of stuff, I thought I did a really good job on that.
For sure. Really. Yeah. That was a lovely army, that.
Yeah.
So it felt like it was a high model count as well.
Yeah, it was loads of bodies.
A lot of guys, a lot of just infantry.
I think there's probably north of 200 miniatures in the army.
Yes. Did you see that international superstar Paige Neo commented on our last Bane chat?
I did.
Thingamajiggy saying he's going to do a wine pairing for his next army.
I didn't see that. Yeah. I played him
just
at Clash.
Just talking about
that
army, it just reminded me.
His army was cool as well. It was like Arabian Nights themed.
You played him in one of the games.
I played him last.
That was it.
Yeah. Fantastic opponent, a real cool guy. But yeah, that was a lovely army. And the first thing was, it was based around a few like Arabian mythology stories, like Aladdin and a couple of others. But he'd bought, apparently like back in the 90s, I think it was, McDonald's Happy Meal had, you know, the sand tiger head?
Yeah, yeah.
In Aladdin, where he goes and gets the magic lantern. He bought one of these. He said it cost him about like $30. Like this rare, like, yeah.
So we didn't buy it in 1995.
Oh, no. He bought this, you know, from someone on eBay who's clearly selling
rare
Happy Meal toys.
Still sealed.
Exactly this, yeah. And it wasn't even like on his army or anything. It was just like, oh, I've got this with me as well.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say like he'd integrated it into a display base or something.
No, nothing of the sort. Just brought it with him.
We didn't want to take it out of his original packaging. I understand that.
That is the energy that we're here for.
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think think sort of unequivocally that's my sort of best project. And I think of the constituent elements of that, it's probably the Spearman units.
Nice.
With the various transfers and all that kind of stuff. And I had a lot of help from Alistair on the 3D kit bashing on that, in the nice, sense we've sort of made Spearmen from halberdiers and stuff.
Oh,
like that.
Nice.
So
cool.
Pretty good, really nice.
I think, assuming that we have to keep this section within the realms of Kings of War.
No, I don't think so. We'll do one.
Oh, God,
one
no,
Kings of War,
no,
one.
No, think about the amount of stuff I paint. I don't know.
Right, well.
But in the realms of Kings of War.
Well, it's a good thing you're not a professional Kings of War painter.
I'm not, you're right. The thing that I was definitely most proud of, but also it never really saw the light of day properly, was when I was trying to figure out how to paint the Riftforged army. I did about half a dozen, maybe seven or eight models in a colour scheme that I never ended up using because it was going to be too much like hard work and all that sort of stuff. But as part of it, I did a banner. If you remember this, it was a banner that was an eye.
I
so
remember,
like
yeah.
The actual banners I ended up with had sort of like cartoon style skulls on them. But the banner that I did originally was a bit like, not 100%, but it was close to like a green version of like the Eye of Sauron from Lord of the Rings.
I remember this now.
Yeah, cool. And when I painted it, I was like, that's arguably one of the better bits of freehand I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And like that made me go, yeah, I'm happy there. And I don't often get that.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Tom?
All I painted for Kings of War this year really is a load of Ratkin. So it's going to be some Ratkin. So like the whole army, it was all pretty unified, but there were a few bits I really liked. One was I did some tunnel runners. And one thing I've never liked about them is they're chariots in terms of base size. They're quite small models. They're a lot smaller than a chariot. And so for the bases they were on, I kind of built it with some rubble and ruins and stuff. But then I pinned them all on funny angles. So they're all like skittering over the ruins and stuff. So they're all on like mad angles. Like, and I really liked that. I think it brought a lot of like energy to the unit, which was like cool. I got
sort of showing movement, aren't you?
Exactly, yeah, without doing anything silly like putting a big like plume of smoke behind them or anything. So
it reminded me of the Baby Bell adverts in the 90s.
It's funny because that's
showing your age,
because that's what he was going for.
Do you not remember the Baby Bell adverts where they unleash, it's the only word I can
unleash the baby bells,
they unleashed a net of baby bells and they all bounced off into the
I can totally picture it. And that
community, I'm going to say.
I don't know if this is Mandela effect, though. I think they just told me that this was an advert.
And they bounced off into the community over the local park or someone's garden or whatever.
I don't remember it, but
no,
I can fully picture it.
Ended up in a lunchbox.
Yeah.
Have you seen that they now do a bell?
What?
Not a baby.
Yeah, like a full-size bell.
Wow.
Yeah, but nobody wants that.
Is it in wax?
There's no... Is that not...
Do they sell...
Damn cheese.
Do they sell baby bells in America? Because if not, this whole section is going to be very localized, but I'm fine with that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
True. So
it'll just lead them to Google it.
Yeah, for the benefit of our international viewers or listeners, more accurately, we're not telling you what baby bell are.
No, just Google it.
No, but you can pair them with an army.
Yeah.
Good point. And it's Ratkin, so cheese. You know.
Oh, you just told them what it is.
Oh, it's cheese.
Yeah.
What's the other things that I was proud of? One of the other things I did was I did some brute enforcers, and they were one of the very few things in the army that weren't Mantic. They were 3D prints, but they were pretty similar to the Mantic model, a big sort of fleshy giant rat monster. But I'd tried something I'd not done before where I sort of, the undercoat on them was quite a light purple, quite a bright purple, and I sprayed, I airbrushed the skin tone onto the purple, so all the sort
really good
of shadows were purple. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird molds where if you held them upside down, they looked terrible. But from the perspective you look at them, it kind of really worked, or like it just gave a really sort of unnatural tone.
It's a really Glenn thing to do that, isn't it? It's like I'm gonna do a base coat shadow with a completely innocuous colour that makes no sense and looks great.
I was about to say that people who put down a colour that's like weird, like there's always a thing about people putting down pink before they paint yellow. I am thoroughly on the side of that makes no difference at all.
Well, no, because with this, it's not like you totally covered it and you couldn't see the purple. It's like if you hold the model upside down, it's purple.
Yeah,
like the
purple. It's not uncommon for your shadow colours to be
not black.
Well, not even just not black, but also just not a darker version of the thing that's on top. There's a contrasting shadow. I think it's quite common in your work.
Also, that yellow example is terrible because that is definitely the easiest way of painting yellow. That's my whole army is. Brown to pink to white and then glazed over with yellow. Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, so they look like marshmallows before you. Like they look like a flump. Okay, do that of you. Not...
Did you try it without the pink?
Yeah, I did. I did, because I did a, in fact, I first tried it on some Crucible God for War Machine, and I had like three jacks and painted differently. And I did the first one of like brown up to bone to white, and then the other one pink. And the pink was just a much, in fact, I'll show you the pictures later. It was just a much richer finish. And there's no, it doesn't look pink at all. It just gives it like a nice warm kind of.
I find my yellows go quite brown, almost browny. Or,
yeah.
They go browny or greeny.
Yeah. Yeah. It made it really, really warm. So for the record, it was. What's annoying is the primer was chaotic red, which they don't make anymore. It's like a really rusty red, a rusty brown, sorry. So it's like a rusty brown. And then scale 75 fuchsia on the top, which is a really bold pink, and then white, and then gold yellow from Vallejo Air.
Well, this is what you come to Bane chat for, isn't it? Sort of painting advice with materials you can no longer buy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can find, it'll work with any kind of lightish reddish brown.
Like those people who buy expired camera film.
Well, those people who spend £30 on a Happy Meal toy that you can't get anymore.
True.
So I think that was me, but overall that was, yeah, an army I was really proud of. It was my first sort of full Mantic Kings of War army planned all together, so yeah. So, fourth. Let's talk about fourth.
Are we looking forward to fourth?
Yeah. Because one thing is, and it's not been intentional, I haven't played a game since Clash. That sounds terrible on the podcast. Be like, oh, we don't actually play this game. We play this game a lot. And it's not that I've not played because of the edition change. It's just been like, life got busy. I got a whole raft of illnesses from my daughter's school. So I had a month where I barely left the house at all, let alone play war games.
We've also probably talked for an hour plus every day on average about fourth since the announcement of fourth came out in our group chat. There's been some interaction about what are you doing, what are you planning, what's the latest thing about fourth that you've heard, what's great, what's terrible. There's been a lot of that, hasn't there?
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, so it's not. I don't think it's fair to say that because I'm also in the same camp as Tom in the sense that I've not played a game of third since fourth was announced. And I actually, truthfully, regret it a bit.
Yeah,
actually, definitely. Like I think I sort of said to myself I wasn't going to play, and that I haven't, and I wish I had. And I've got quite a sort of obsessive magpie type nature where I have to have a thing to be into at a particular time. So, I've in the intervening period bought a Lord of the Rings army that probably won't see a lot of play.
Square bases, mate. It'll be fine.
Yeah, true. But yeah, so I am really excited for fourth. I think that there has been a mixed reaction to it, but at the same point, it's just going to bring more eyes to the game. And the opportunity to have different people in our community or different people attending my events, different opponents, I think it's just going to be good. And also, truthfully, we were getting to the point of completedness with third. I think we were starting to see the types of armies that each faction did best, and switching up that meta significantly is going to be a positive thing to me.
I agree with that. I think when it was first announced, again, it's another Clash story. We do other things that aren't Clash, but I was talking to both Ronnie and Alessio on the Sunday after the announcement had been made.
Of course you were.
And the way that they were talking about it, or the way that they sort of sold it, I guess, was that it's going to be different, but it's another puzzle to unlock. And I've kind of kept that in my head throughout all of the previews and all of the rest of it, because I think that's a positive way of looking at it. There has been a mixed reaction, and there are bits of it that I've sort of thought, ooh, I'm not sure how that's going to work. Mm. Like, I've never had a negative experience from being shot off the board in Kings of War, but other people obviously have. Mm-hmm. But I think there's if there's a new puzzle to unlock, I like that. And that's enough reason for me to be excited about it. I also think that Mantic as a company need some hype behind the game. I think that now's the time. I do think the future's pretty bright for it. I think it's good.
Here's a quick question, actually, and it's just come to me. The idea of gunline armies is a problem in war games at large, but hasn't been a problem in Kings of War specifically.
Sure.
To what extent is that a feedback point from the wider war games community, perhaps, rather than specifically Kings?
Yeah, maybe.
There's obviously everyone's bringing their own experience of these things to the design table. So I wonder to what extent Alessio is influenced by his experience of other games.
I don't know, because something just, I'm not going to say it doesn't sit right with me, but I've never played a war game where you don't get shot off, you don't get killed from shooting.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a choice, and I know it's been spoken about to the death online and all that sort of side, but I know that from what I've seen, the reason that they've given for doing it is because they're like, it's a very negative experience to get a unit shot off the board. But a lot of the things in Kings, a lot of the things that shoot in Kings either don't have the range for it, or it takes such a significant portion of a gun line, in inverted commas, army to do it, that it's almost not really a concern. I remember I drew Alistair's pretty heavily shooting elf army at the start of the last Shroud of the Saint tournament, and I was a little bit apprehensive about it because it was something like 120 odd shots.
Bow shots a turn, yeah.
So I was apprehensive about it. I was going into that game thinking this is going to be one of the few negative play experiences from Kings because I have a very melee-focused army. It's going to get shot off the board before I can get there. I did have Veil of Shadows to cover it a little bit.
A lot of defense five.
I did fail Veil in the first turn, so that was good. However, it became apparent that of 3/4 of those bow shots would be required to hit an orc unit and get it on average dice to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't see where people are saying, I've been heavily shot off the board on turn one and I don't have a comeback in this game. I've not seen it.
So, Alzheimer, let's try and off the top of our heads remember what was in it. It was a couple of units of the basic archers.
A few chariots, wasn't there?
Three kings on chariots who have a surprisingly good range attack.
Yeah.
A horde of the
Theronian Seaguard.
Two units of Silver Breach Cav, I think it was.
Yeah.
There were a couple of units of the regular Cav as well, so it wasn't 100%. It wasn't as many guns as you could fit in.
But I think the key stat was it was 120 bow shots a turn at either that was majority 4+ shooting with elite.
Yeah, I think it's, like I say, it's not obviously the most guns you can pack into an army, but I think it's one of the most effective gun line armies you could make in the game.
Yeah, lots of high quality shoots.
Yeah, but with some fast and punchy melee to back it up. Yeah.
It's a heavy skew.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. But even like you say, playing into that as an army that's somewhat vulnerable to guns, because I played into it as well, as an army that doesn't have Veil of Shadows, fairly vulnerable to guns, didn't feel bad. It was like, this is a challenge that I have to play around. It's like with my Ratkin, it's like I can use my Vermin Swarms to block, to give my units cover. So I've got to make sure I'm putting my Vermin Swarms in the right place to block things. I've got to make sure that if he's going to shoot me, I can counterattack with something, that sort of thing. So it was a challenge, but it wasn't, I'm getting shot off the board, this is no fun, which is absolutely an experience I've had in other games.
I'll be honest, my only negative army archetype that I experience is high defense, regen, heal spam.
Yeah, 100%.
Those are much more negative experiences to me than shooting armies.
100%.
And also, none of that's been mentioned as being changed.
No. Because the other problem is with shooting, you know, now you're not breaking units. And I think that actually might work out okay. If they've kept a lot of the regen heal stuff in the game, shooting's going to be like, you know, they're saying, oh, shooting's going to be good for chip damage. You know, you build it up over time. Yeah, you cause damage on the way in and then break them in melee. If you can regen and heal it all back, that's gonna be a bad feeling.
Well, I think actually, if you look at the Phoenix has been adjusted.
That's
in some
a
way,
really
hasn't
good
it?
Change. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's lost heal, hasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, which might be a sort of a wider sort of
obviously regen's still going to exist in the game, but hopefully not on the same numbers and the same quantity.
You're going to hit like abyssals, though. Abyssals are full.
That's their whole thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because I think the difficulty with that kind of regen heal kind of build. Although to be fair, actually, just to dial it back from that very slightly. One of the issues that you have with the change in the rules is far more likely to be jammed up by wavering chaff now, in the sense of like that gargoyle unit that was definitely going to go from a mind fog turn one because you shot it twice with bows and then cast mind fog on it is now just going to sit in front of your line and you can't get past it, and I think that is going to be a new challenge for players to deal with.
Yeah,
I agree with that, and I've heard a couple of people say that, so I see it. I just think it's a I think my
I don't
question,
think it's
my question
I think it's
really
a good improvement though, like I don't think that's a good that's not a fun challenge to unlock.
It slows the game down.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah,
and then the other thing is because they have regen, don't they? Which you never use them because like you say when you hit them they're dead.
Yeah.
But now you're gonna waver them and then they're gonna be annoying in your way for one turn, but then next turn they're gonna regen all their health back and then be back again. And so we'll see how it plays out. Like I think I'm fine with the shooting change, but if regen's not been reined in a bit, that's going to be...
On the plus side, I'm looking for, I've finally committed to ordering some Zerkali this afternoon, so that is happening.
Dogman!
So I'm looking forward to that, painting-wise. And also, I like the idea that it's a brand new army, so I won't have to make a comparison to what my third edition of it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm going to enjoy that a lot, and I think the sort of the modeling side of it and figuring that out is going to be good. So, what do you think, Tom?
I think
generally, false.
The biggest positive by a long way for me is the army construction rules.
Yes,
hard agree.
I've been throwing together some Nightstalker lists, and Nightstalkers have not had the full rule spoiler. They've had some ideas of what's going to be core, what's going to be specialist, and that. But now you can kind of do it pretty much in your head. You're like, oh well, that'll be my four core. So then I'm going to bring four specialists along with that, and that's going to unlock a character and three support. And so you can kind of, even without, if you know roughly what the points values are, you could just sort of think, oh, will that work as an army? Whereas at the moment, you're building an army, it's like, go to companion.
I've got a live Christmas challenge for you, Tom.
Ooh.
Can you explain the third edition army building rules to me off the top of your head?
Well, we try to keep these podcasts under an hour, so...
So no, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like... I actually couldn't. And that's the thing. We've played this game pretty consistently for 3 years. We're all pretty much, 4 years, and we're all very much into this game. And it's like, still, it's like... I know, obviously, the main thing, regiments and hordes are unlocking, but I couldn't tell you what all the unlocks are. You kind of...
Do you unlock a hero, a monster, and a troop?
I think that's a lot.
It also depends on some things unlock two troops, some things unlock a
what unlocks two troops?
Hordes, I think, unlock two troops.
But here's the problem. So infantry, I think
this is genuine. I don't know.
I think infantry hordes unlock one of each, a war machine, a monster, and a hero. Right. But then a horde of large infantry, so trolls, whatever.
Oh right.
They unlock two of any of them. So I think a horde of trolls unlocks two catapults. I think. Or two heroes, or two, or
right. I think what you can sort of plainly see is that three people who play Kings of War regularly and make lists very regularly rely solely on the Mantic Companion to tell us about lists.
And thankfully, the Companion's really good at that. But yeah, that's the thing. Now I can be like, now you have to do that. You're like, okay, I can see how this is going to work. I can see, because that's sometimes the Companion, your list's illegal. It's I guess I hit add on the cheapest troop, the cheapest infantry regiment again, and hope that makes the red bar go away.
I think I could tell people the 4th edition.
Oh yeah,
despite having never played it.
Yeah.
4th edition list construction rules.
But as well, I'll probably rely on the Companion a little bit in 4th.
Oh, for sure.
But I know how to start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need a HQ and two troops. I'm sorry, that's what it's called.
And also, if there's an issue with it, it's much more intuitive to know the fix.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. So I think that's really good.
The additional pivots in some of the movement orders are going to change the game enormously.
Yeah.
And that is it. So for example, if you look at fast, hard-hitting hammer units, one of the big improvements that you could make to those in 3rd or 3.5 was to give them Wine of Elvenkind and give them Nimble.
Yeah.
Apart from charges, which you generally speaking didn't need Nimble for fast flying hammers, you're going to get a pivot on the march. So you can move, for example, a unit of Beast Cavalry, a unit of Drakons, 20 inches up the board and turn 90 degrees and look down the entire line.
Yeah.
And I think that is going to be a very significant change in how a lot of armies play.
Imagine if you were playing end-to-end on a 6x4 board, that wouldn't be as effective.
Interestingly, I was looking at this the other day, having watched one of Steve Hildreth's battle reports. The distance that you set up from is still the same in all deployments.
Yeah.
But you would have a deeper backfield if you knew
you're
facing that. If you were deploying against my Riftforge with two units of Hellstrikers, and I put them on the flanks, you would set up on 3 inches away from the back of your board.
Yeah.
It's almost like they've thought about it.
Yeah. The other thing is, it's one of those things where at the start it's going to catch people out. But then you're like, okay, so you put your health strikers on the flank. I know that what you want to do is go first, run them up 20 and pivot them. So I'm just going to put a unit here which will keep that in my threat range.
Yeah.
Sure, expose your flank to me. And then you obviously not going to do that. I can take off the board or be like, at least if you're going to do it now, you've got to do it from further away. You can't run your whole, you can't just scream 20 inches towards me and pivot.
It's a new puzzle to unlock.
Exactly.
One of the limitations of third, particularly for infantry units and other sort of non-nimble things, is as soon as you've got something behind you, you haven't got the mobility to do anything about it.
Sure.
Whereas I think this opportunity to back up and pivot or move sideways and pivot will open up a lot of different play.
Yeah, I agree, and I like that, because one thing that I used to find playing Dwarves a lot was exactly that. You had to have units that were backstops. If you don't have to have that quite so heavily now, then that, yeah, I think that's improving.
One of the factors that we have all been talking about, and probably talk about to death on Fanatics, is the need to sort of view the rule set in a sort of a holistic sense. And because it's very easy to look at individual things in isolation and not necessarily appreciate how they work in the wider game experience. And that's not to necessarily make apologies for things that seem to be slightly negative or sort of contrary to how we would have done things had we had the opportunity to be involved. But there are a few changes in terms of the increases in the points for characters, which until we start playing this game will not necessarily be very easy to work out whether that's good value. Mm-hmm. So characters have gone up significantly in points in some instances. But I think if you've got a wizard character who is moving around, scoring, giving commands,
yeah,
and casting spells,
yeah,
the utility is much wider. And I think that will go some way to explain the change in the points cost of characters.
We've said it before, haven't we, that options are the way to go. If you have a unit you can deploy that does more than one thing, then it's generally a good thing. And if you're now paying for it in points for those characters, then it makes sense. I think that I've realised I'm going to reserve full judgment until after Shroud of the St. Helens. Three, four. because by that point, it's the second week of February, more or less. At the end of Shroud of the St. Helens, I will have had my first 8 to 10 games.
Well, I think we've talked about having a betwixtmas 4th edition Kings of War Day, haven't we?
Christmas New Year lull. Yeah, I'd love that. One of the great things, of course, about characters is the larger base size. Like, making little dioramas and stuff now is, like, super cool.
I painted something that I can't talk about for the studio. Ooh. That was a particularly small hero on a particularly large base, and I couldn't do anything in the basing because I'm not allowed.
I can't believe Glenn still won't talk about the pigmen that are getting released next year.
But I did the same thing. I had the horror, the Night Stalker character, who's just like a little floaty goblin. He was not a goblin, a little floaty guy with a big mouth. And yeah, he'd be small on a 20 mil base. I put on a 40 mil base, so I was like, huh. But like, it's cool because I was thinking I might do like a ring of fire around him or something, or you know what I mean? Like,
you can figure something
out. Yeah.
I've got to put my 20 mil captain on a 40 mil base, who is currently in the center spot of my display board, and the opportunity to go, well, I've now got 40 mil to play with here, do something completely different, a little kind of scenic.
I think men is the best one because you have his little squires behind him or something, don't you? Exactly. Your little tactical table or.
I think that's it. Like the sort of the opportunity for the general to not be a guy on a base, but the sort of who is the elf hero? Who is Argus Rodnar?
Rodnar, yeah, with the sort of altar thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like the idea of having like the general with the war plans open.
Yeah.
On the table,
oh my goodness,
his guys.
Because I love that when it got announced, there were a few people moaning on Fanatics like, oh, "I've got to rebase everything." And then Bob just came along with a Northern Alliance guy and a big old like display scenic base, and it was like, Bob gets it.
Yeah, looks great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, shout out to Mantic for making the little clippy new base extender things. Like, they will solve the problem in the blink of an eye for a lot of people.
I think actually more so than the clicky and base extender for characters, that modular regiment troop setup that they've got is a bit of a sleeper, I think, at the moment. Because although you could do it by 3D printing and all that kind of stuff, and it's a thing that people have done in the past with magnets and stuff to try and extend the utility of their base models, I think that's really clever.
I'm interested to see if the Zerkali will come with those or not.
I think they will.
Oh, I hope so.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Well, I think there has been some suggestion that they're doing away with MDF bases.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing with them is it's going to be hard to pin models to them, because normally when I do bases I do a sheet of cork on top of MDF. So but you can.
If they're plastic, if they're injection molded plastic, you can just.
Oh, I suppose glue models like you glue any model to a base.
Yeah,
yeah.
You can plastic glue them, can't you?
I find it really difficult to take this with a pinch of salt, because I'm primarily a sort of a resin model user, but even if you were taking it with plastics, I would tend to paint my plastics and do my bases separately and then glue them one to the other.
Exactly is what I was getting at, yeah.
True.
Yeah, yeah.
True, yeah.
So, well, we'll work it out though, and I. Like you say, I'm probably going to still. In fact, I have been 3D printing on my Nightstalker bases this week, which has been really fun.
Yeah, look cool. Is that with the columns and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. The bases themselves are from Xarli Factory, TXARLI. I don't know how you pronounce that word, Xarli. But I've sort of, you get, when you buy the bases, you get a big base texture with it. So I've sort of digitally cut out all the right shapes for all the stuff.
And that's impressive.
Yeah, it works really nice. But the other thing I like about them is they're pretty tall. They're about 5 mil tall or something, and they just give your unit a bit more of a, I guess that's more like the equivalent of like a sort of GW style base.
I do like a chunky base.
They're about that tall rather than being on like the flat MDF, which I really like. Yeah, so we don't have, a way of sharing pictures, do we, for Bane Chat?
It's an audio format.
We'll work out.
Yeah, you'll never see us at Clash because we only exist as an audio format. Yeah. You might hear us at Clash, but you'll never see us.
What you will see at Clash next year, if we continue to get a sort of resounding base of listeners, is you'll see Tom in a t-shirt that is not black.
No, it's not happening, mate.
Do you reckon? I think we can do it. We've got a year to wear him down.
Remind me, who does our graphics again? Is it me? It's me, isn't it?
Hang on, who ordered the t-shirts last year?
And that's the real skill, clicking out to cart. Yeah. No, you guys can all have your bright orange t-shirt. I'm going to have a black t-shirt with the orange. I'm going to have the school guy. Who needs a name? The school guy, you know. But that's going to be an orange field on a black t-shirt.
Fine. Okay. Fine. So welcome to the segment of the show where we are going to do our quick fire Christmas questions.
We've had two episodes so far. We've kept really on track. This is, you know, I mean, let's be honest. There's no more King's Talk. If you're not here for arguing about Christmas foods, then we'll see you in the new year.
Yeah,
but if you like petty Christmas arguments, we've probably got another 20 minutes of content for you here.
Yeah, minimum. So the first question is, what is the best Christmas food, Glenn?
Christmas pudding, but as long as it's got custard and nothing else.
What is the best Christmas food, Tom?
Well, I mean, I'd like to interrogate it, but I mean, well, part of the problem is that he's, you know what, he's right, it's Christmas pudding. I don't agree with the whole, why just custard? What about, you say nothing else?
Well, yeah.
No brandy on top?
No, you do the brandy.
Sure, set it on fire.
You get the pudding, you put the brandy on, you set the brandy on fire, then you serve the pudding, then you put custard on top, that's it.
Will you not accept a brandy cream on top?
I don't
or a thick cream.
Do you know what? Maybe it's just the Christmas puddings that we have, but I don't feel like you need any more alcohol in it.
Sure,
because
that's fair.
If it starts.
We're not going to get into this, are we?
No, we are getting into this. We are getting deep into this.
Starts to taste like you're just having a shot of brandy.
That's fair, but I think I really like just like a thick cream, like even like a clotted cream. It's good. No,
it's got to be custard.
I do love custard.
I'm common as muck, mate.
I like Christmas pudding, and I would be particularly interested to hear if anyone had a particularly good Christmas pudding recipe amongst the podcasters that we have here.
Go on, man, tell a story.
I've inherited a super secret recipe from my stepfather, and it was handed down to him from many generations past, and I've finally made it this year, and I don't know what it's like yet because it's not quite Christmas, but I've gone for it. I've tried it. I've got two of them. We'll see what happens. It's very special to him and maybe very special to me if I can get it right.
Can I have some?
Yeah.
Save me some. I really want some. Because I
asked you for some, you said no.
Yeah, but you're not Tom.
Yeah, you're gonna like take it to a food lab or something and work it out. I'm just gonna scoff it there and then. That's the difference between me and you.
Actually, it depends on how much brandy you pour in the top.
Sacrilegious bastard. I love Christmas pudding, but I have one portion of Christmas pudding a year.
Okay.
The thing that I like about Christmas in terms of Christmas foods that is available throughout the Christmas period, and you can have multiples of them. Is I love mince pies.
So you're going to say turkeys? You can have multiples of them, turkeys.
I love a mince pie. What's...
In fairness, I was actually going to say panettone, but thought you'd all think I was ferociously middle class.
No, I think we need to... After this guy being pouring custard over his Christmas pudding, we need someone to bring us back up a bit. I love panettone as well.
Yeah.
We've all gone sweet.
Yeah.
Well, I think, actually, if I can't do Christmas pudding because...
I need to go back a little bit. Right. What? How about this? Christmas pudding with... custard over the top and a little bit of nutmeg sprinkles on top.
Custard is great on I'm not saying that. I didn't like the puritanism of it can only be custard. I think you can, anyway, we've done enough Christmas pudding chat. The second best Christmas food is, okay, so you have your Christmas dinner on Christmas Day, and then the next day everyone makes turkey curry, which is garbage. The correct thing to do with your Christmas leftovers is to make a turkey and leek pie.
My guy.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's how you use leftovers.
We can agree on
that. You've got some ham in there. Oh. Yeah.
Did I make a load of those at one point?
You did. In fact, you made so many that you came up to me and put it in my freezer, and I did eat it. It was delicious.
The turkey and leek pie is the Boxing Day special.
Yeah, somebody tries to make you turkey curry this year, say, shove it, I'm making a pie.
Yeah.
Okay, Jed, worst Christmas food that's not sprouts?
What? Sprouts are great.
I like sprouts.
I know. Okay. What I'm saying is they're generally accepted that people don't like them. So you can't say that as a bad answer.
So,
worst one.
My father-in-law insists that this is a central feature of Christmas
dinner. Oh, we love a Christmas debate.
And I have never had this until such time as I had Christmas dinner at their house.
Tomato ketchup.
Bread sauce can fuck up.
No, you're making it wrong. How are you making your bread sauce?
I'm not making it. It's basically the texture of porridge.
I can't really argue that. Yeah.
Say it, Jed, I agree. 100%. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's the worst, so I've got my own choice, but it's not good.
Overrated. There's a reason why it happens once a year. If it was
good, yeah.
Do you know, like when you go on holiday and they say you've got to try the local thing and the local thing's pizza, you're like, yeah, of course I've tried pizza. It's lovely. We have it everywhere. And they go, it's the local thing. You've never heard of it because it's rubbish. Like bread sauce happens once a year because it only deserves that.
I think you have it once a year because it only really goes with turkey. You only have turkey once a year.
Does it go with turkey?
I think it does.
You've got to... The thing is, you've got to put quite a lot of spices in it, or it's just like porridge. You've got to have plenty of nutmeg, plenty of cloves in there, plenty of onion as well. Because the way I've made it in the past is boiling an onion with cloves and nutmeg for like half an hour in milk. Yeah, but sprouts, yeah, we all agree on sprouts. You got to cook them right.
Yeah.
Got to fry them with your bacon.
Fry them with your bacon, steam them with garlic is another good way of doing it. Or you can make a little choucroute, a little sprout choucroute. It's like a sort of a hot sauerkraut.
Ooh.
I can't believe you didn't know that one.
So it's like finely shredded sprouts, maybe some lard on, a little bit of white wine vinegar. Ooh, what an absolute treat.
I'm going to throw in what I think is not a good Christmas food.
Okay.
This is probably going to be controversial to some people. It's definitely controversial to my wife, but she won't listen to this. Christmas cake. I'll tell you for why. When is the right time to eat Christmas cake?
I think...
I want to know. I think when is the right time?
My problem with Christmas cake is it's a dessert made with dried fruit and alcohol and spices... And we already have Christmas pudding and we already have mince pies. So why, that's my problem with it. If mince pies and Christmas pudding didn't exist, I'd be like, oh, I love a bit of Christmas cake. But it's just a drier, heavier version of something that I like.
I like Christmas cake, but if someone said, would you like a piece of Christmas cake or would you like a little bowl of Christmas pudding?
Oh, gosh.
You'd probably go for a little bowl of Christmas pudding. You know what?
Christmas cake has one role, and that is to be decorated with a lovely winter scene on top. A nice white icing over the top, get some old chintzy models of people skiing.
You can do that with an ogre army, mate. You said we don't have Kings of Wartalk.
Yeah, that's, you know what? Christmas pudding pairing for...
Snogus.
Christmas pudding pairing for Clash Jet. Make it happen.
The Bane Chant festive post.
Can I do one that's gonna get us cancelled for the worst Christmas food?
Go on.
It's pigs in blankets.
I've heard this from you before, I wouldn't say I've been persuaded, but I can see the force.
The problem with pigs in blankets, which in the UK is not a sausage roll, it's a sausage wrapped in bacon, is what's great about sausages and bacon. And I love both these things. You have them with something that's either acidic or sweet to cut through the salty fattiness. So you have like tomato ketchup on a bacon butty is the best thing because you have that sweet acid that goes with the salt. When you combine a sausage with bacon, all you get is more salty fat.
I get the argument, but I think that that's a problem with the dinner overall. I think that the dinner needs more of your sweet or your acid in it.
Yeah,
if I ever go home to Christmas, my mum does very nice baked onions with the Christmas dinner.
Ooh,
and they have cream pod over the top of them. And
cream on top of them.
Yeah, yeah.
They're
half onions baked, and they bring acidity to it.
That sounds not a million miles from bread sauce, though.
No. There's no starch. There's no.
It's just an onion cooked. It's an onion cooked in dairy, which is in and of itself a weird thing.
I respect your opinion in relation to pigs in blankets, but it's not what I share, and it's not what I would say that is endorsed by Bain Chat.
I think I get it. There are single taste, and they're very, very concentrated in that thing.
Yeah,
but I think it's you've got to have the right complement to it.
Yeah, but I don't think they're better than either of their constituent parts.
I think that's probably true. That I would say is the spiciest take of the ones we've seen.
Do you know what you want? You want some homemade cranberry sauce with it.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah.
Homemade.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's like quite citrusy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Quite sharp. Yeah. That's. But then the other thing is, you're already having turkey. You might be having some ham. You have some stuffing. It's like, do I really want a sausage and some bacon? No, I don't.
You do.
I don't. I don't. I won't have them on my plate. One last argument.
Put them on the plate.
Do you have a Yorkshire pudding on your Christmas dinner?
100%.
Yeah.
Not even an argument.
Hundo P.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
they're so good. They are so nice.
Now I hope Heather listens. Not Heather Armstead. Heather, my wife, listens to this podcast because she hates the phrase Hundo P.
I'm not sure I've heard it before.
I know where I've heard it before, but I'm not going to call Jed out.
Is it RuPaul or something like that?
No, it jugs the podcast.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm learning a lot.
It turns out I've called him out.
Yeah.
It's a Louise Sugden thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I think that Yorkshire puddings are just a lovely addition to a roast.
The problem is that they're meant to be traditionally only for beef, and we're being old traditional at Christmas, but I'll break tradition because Yorkshire puddings...
My family's half Yorkshire, mate. We've never not had them.
I'd agree.
Also, have you ever had stand pie? Speaking of Yorkshire traditions at Christmas... Jed's looking at me like I'm like. Go on, Jed.
We're now in a land and we just at parking at Christmas. Like,
what? Parking at Christmas? Are you insane? That's the wrong time of year. It's not a pie, it's a big pork pie.
Not a fan. Carry on. I don't like a normal pork pie. It's bigger, and I'm not excited for what you're about to say next. But go on, what's different about it?
What are you talking about? You don't like pork pie?
Well, hang on. So was that the end of your sentence when you said it's a pork pie but bigger? No, that's all it is.
No, but you've just said more controversial things on top of
okay. Okay, now go on. Finish me off. What's the rest of your big pork pie doing?
It's a big pork pie. And it's called a stand pie because you make it and then you leave it to stand for a while.
Oh, good. So right. The thing that I don't like, there's more of it and it's gone off.
No, hang on. It's not gone off. You fool. It's like
sounds like it's. I mean, Paige, you know how.
Look, it's not a part of the Christmas dinner.
No. Oh, no.
I mean, it can be.
That would be absurd, wouldn't it?
It just. You know, like how pastry, you know how you get like. You go into a baker's and you get like a pastry and someone will be like, oh, it's day old pastry, so it's cheaper because it's not as nice. So, but the selling point of this is that it's gone dry and horrid.
No, it's not gone dry and horrid. You don't leave it for like 4 weeks. I don't know how long you leave it for, I'll be honest with you.
I mean, it sounds trash. I'm not eating it. I'm not interested.
And stop disrespecting my family traditions, please.
No. I think the thing with you historically with sort of hand raised pork pies is the fingers width of jelly around the sides.
I just don't.
That they don't have.
You swayed me slightly, but
I use polyfiller.
Oh gosh. Okay.
Hey, look it up. I think you're a man who will try anything.
If you brought me a slice, if you brought me a slice of it, especially if you had a bit of applesauce or something, I'd give it a go.
So now that we have alienated our entire audience,
fixed Christmas dinner.
The next question is best Christmas film that isn't The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Yeah, because off the bat, we can all agree that Muppets Christmas Carol is the best Christmas film, right?
Agreed. Yeah,
it just is.
Tom, you have a fairly solid choice on this.
Okay. I watched this yesterday, actually. It's not one that I watch every year, but I watched it last night. And I, as is tradition, I cried about 5 times during it. And it's that's strange. It's an animation, and it's Klaus. Klaus is on Netflix. You should watch it. It starts as like a slightly, not kiddie comedy, but a bit kind of...
Family.
Yeah, like a sort of family comedy. And then... About halfway through, there's just a gut punch, and then, in my opinion, it does not stop gut punching. But it's really lovely. It's very sweet and heartfelt. It's really, really, really good film. It's like it looked beautiful as well. Like the animation's really lovely. It's one of my favorite films, not just Christmas films. Klaus on Netflix. Give it a go.
Okay, Glenn.
I want to go back to the 90s classics.
Okay.
I've got two, but I'll be honest with you, I don't watch a lot of Christmas films, mm-hmm. but. The two that stand out are Home Alone,
of course,
for Joe Pesci and so on. I read a great thing about the Wet Bandits. Is Joe Pesci and who's the guy? They're famous, isn't he? Anyway, whoever it was, when they filmed it, the story went that they thought it was going to be a flop. Those two thought it was
sure.
be like a flop. Yeah, pan yeah, yeah. So they like. Just took the piss with their characters. They're just like really over exaggerated everything about them, and then
And that was
just everyone like, had their own fun. Yeah. They have their own fun and this will be nothing.
That's
and
it amazing. Turned out to be Home Alone. That actually, yeah. And like, if you explained the plot to someone, you'd be like, what?
So,
I mean, that checks, yeah.
But I think honorable mention goes to Jingle All the Way.
I'm not sure. Which one's that?
The Arnie one.
Turbo Man.
I have not seen it.
What?
Okay, to the uninitiated, why should I see Jingle All the Way apart from it's got Arnie in it, which is obviously a selling point?
Because it has the line, I'm going to win because I've got a bigger brain than you in it.
Yeah. It has the classic trope of dad is not seeing enough of family.
Okay.
Dad decides to do a thing for Christmas to improve relationship with son.
And it all goes wrong.
Hijinks ensue.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's like an easy watch.
Trying to get the best toy for that year.
It's a classic setup.
Turbo Man action figure.
Then he's got like a nemesis who's a postman, isn't he?
I wasn't in the deep lore of Jingle All the Way.
The spoiler is that they end up in a parade at the end by sheer accident, and they're dressed as the doll, and like Arnie's obviously this superhero doll.
The postman
nemesis ends up as his nemesis, and he's got a big plastic brain on top of his head, hence the line.
Oh. I'm going to watch this. I'm assuming it's streaming somewhere.
But this time of year you'll pay £8.99.
So for me it's short and sweet. I canonically have seen less than 20 films. So I'm sort of picking from a limited pool, and three of them are the Muppets Christmas Carol. So my selection is Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton classic. I really enjoy it.
I was going to say it.
Yeah.
But then I didn't know if it straddled the line of Halloween film, because we watched it on Halloween this year.
I think it genuinely does. But I did a Google to see how many of the Christmas films listed on Google that I had seen, and it was the first one I had seen.
Fair.
So that's how you selected.
Yeah.
Just the first one.
Well, it's
have you not seen like Elf?
No.
Really?
Neither have I.
What?
No.
I was like, this is like that was gonna be the other one.
I'll
like,
tell you the other shot. I've never seen the Grinch either.
Both Grinches are really good.
I saw about 15 minutes of the Grinch at a friend's house the other day, and it did seem like it might be worth watching.
Argument about the Grinch is that...
Not the Jim Carrey one.
Okay. My argument about the Grinch is that I really like reading the books, My Child's a Bedtime Story.
Oh, sure.
There's a
okay.
high chance it's going to ruin the book. And it's a really nice Dr. Seuss book.
They're the same story.
Are they?
Like the end won't be any different. Won't spoil you.
Yeah, but it is probably one of those things where I'm guessing the book takes you about 6 minutes to read, and that's being extended.
A little bit longer, but
it's being extended to an hour and a half film.
Yeah, and the other thing is, well, I didn't know that. Is there two? Because one's a Jim Carrey one.
There are,
the famous
which
one,
is yeah. fantastic. But then they did what's normally a recipe for a terrible film. They remade a beloved classic in CGI.
Right.
But it's actually really good. And they're very different as well. Yeah. And I think...
It's probably much more closer to the Dr. Seuss one, the CGI one, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And
I do remember that.
And the jokes in it are good as well. It's there's room for both, I reckon.
Christmas film's done.
Last one, best Christmas song. So I have two.
The other thing is, I should have said best Christmas food, not Christmas pudding. Best Christmas film, that's not The Muppets. Best Christmas song, that's not Fairy Tale of New York.
Okay, for me, bit of homework for you guys.
Okay.
So, in the song Fairy Tale of New York, the song starts with the protagonist being taken to the drunk tank, which is basically a jail cell where you're sort of going to go and dry off. And he talks about this really mournful song that is sung by an old man in the room. And that song is called The Rare Old Mountain Dew. That is the least mournful song you will ever hear.
Mm-hmm.
And is about whiskey. The song starts, I diddle-diddle-dum, diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle.
Well, yeah.
It's give me a drop of the rare old stuff that's made near Galway Bay. Listen to The Rare Old Mountain Dew. But I have two favourite Christmas songs. One of them is for very personal reasons, in the sense that it's become my sort of semi-Christmas anthem, which is Stop the Cavalry. And there have been various videos sent to our group chat over the years of me either dancing to it or performing it on kazoo or various bits and pieces like
Christmas
that.
Christmas tradition.
For a more contemporary option, Underneath the Tree by Kelly Clarkson.
My wife's favourite.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best modern Christmas songs.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I don't know it.
Really? You will have heard it. You'll have heard it in supermarkets. And it's like, it's one of them. It's not like, oh man, this is a really powerful. It's just a fun Christmas jingle.
Lovely pop song.
Yeah, exactly that.
Lovely fun pop song. Okay. Go on, Tom, if you've got something.
I've got a few.
A few in the tank.
Well, yeah, but I love the Wren Collective do some Christmas albums, and they're kind of a mix of like your carols and some original stuff. They're really nice, like Irish folksy. Dustin Kensrue, the guy from Thrice, has a belting Christmas album.
I really listened to that this week.
In fact, that's what I was listening to on the way over here. It's quality. And then if we could do one song, there's a song I love called Maybe Next Year by Jenny Owen Youngs, and it's just a bit melancholic as well.
Okay.
Maybe this is the thing, it's like, yeah.
Just melancholy?
Yeah, I think that's nice to be, you know, it's like the opposite of Underneath the Tree, but it's a...
Is that because you're miserable Christmas dinner without your, like, pigs in blankets on standby?
Yeah, basically, everything about Christmas for me has to be tinged with sadness.
Unless it's Jim Carrey.
It can't be happy. Everything has to be a gut punch.
I don't know why. Is anyone else imagining sort of Glenn's Christmas dinner having an enormous sort of set pie in the middle of it and then all his Christmas dinner on top?
No!
Christmas dinner's not heavy enough, it needs an entire pie.
Have you got some?
I've not. That's it.
No, that's fine.
Sorry.
All the good songs have been said.
Yep.
Yeah.
None are left to be sung. Well,
yeah.
with that, what we will leave you with is our New Year goals.
Oh, yeah. Well, we do have more Kings of War to talk about.
We do. So, my New Year goal, I have two. The first is to fit my Kingdoms of Men army into a 4th edition army list with as little modification as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully not having to add any new units, but I will if I have to, and also to get my Snogers ready for Clash 2026.
What's my goal? I think in the back of my head, the issue I've got is I know I'm lined up for a load of stuff for the studio in the new year. So I think keeping my head above water in terms of pile of shame and balancing that would be good. If I can end 2025 with around about the same amount of unpainted models in my house that I currently have, which isn't that many, I'll be happy. I think if I can, yeah, there's about, I've got about 3 or 4 boxes of stuff that's unopened, and that's...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't have a pile of shame.
I have 126 Mordor orcs.
Yeah, I mean, I'll have a load of Zerkali, but they'll get painted.
Nice. Yeah, for me, it's like, I mean, like, you guys want to finish my Clash army. It's quite a high model count. Well, what's weird is it's... I'm selling all the scarecrows at the moment. It's quite a lot of scarecrows. But then, apart from that, it seems to be quite a lot of big stuff too, so maybe not too high model count.
Is it unusual to be talking about doing our Clash army in December when it's September next year?
No, absolutely not.
The thing is, what we mean is our Kings of War armies.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. We'll be playing in June, probably, won't we? Like, yeah. Our Clash army for one of them.
God, I mean, I'm hoping to have mine done by, kind of, April. Not finished, but, like, table ready. No. But that's the thing. You say Clash army, it's like Clash kind of marks the end of the
season.
The end of the season, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, like, I'd like to up my competitive game a bit this year. I feel like I've done last year's bids of Clash, I've been doing well in the run up to it, and then just sort of like dropped the ball in a few games and not played as well as I'd like to. And like, that's not the main thing of Clash, of course. The main thing about Clash is having a real good time, seeing friends, making new friends. But I think I'd like to push my competitive gaming up a bit this year, I think.
I think with a big meta shift, there's never been a better opportunity for that.
Yeah.
Because everyone's coming down to a sort of a baseline to some degree.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I'm happy with the level of competitiveness,
sure,
I am at.
Because you do quite well, like, probably,
yeah,
why.
Sure. Yeah.
I didn't at Clash, not this
no,
time.
No, but I mean, like, for someone who, like...
Who doesn't play very often.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's
like,
it.
You genuinely perform very well at events when you go to them.
Yeah.
I do all right.
Yeah, we
I submarine a lot.
Yeah.
I always lose one round to someone dead good and then win the rest of them. And then...
That's... Yeah. Well, that's it. I think part of that is I want to get more games in with you guys, because we tend to not get as many casual games in. We all have 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
We're currently sitting at a 6x4 foot table.
The Americans are angry at last.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
well, this is it. I think that if you sort of really press it, there's 6 Kings of War players within 30 minutes of where we're sat.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we also all have careers and families.
Yeah, like, that's it. But I think, and it's that thing of like, I think what I want to do is, yeah, be more intentional about saying, we're going to play a game next week. Let's get this booked in. Let's do it, you know. Because we don't really do that, you know, and then you go, oh, this week, oh, maybe get a game of Kings in, and then the week rolls on, you don't get a chance.
Yeah.
True. So we're more like, okay, let's play a game next week. Let's put in our calendars and let's not move in.
Yeah. I wonder if we could do a mini league.
Like, what, 4 people?
Yeah, 4 or 5 people.
Yeah.
And just be like, either sort of like, everyone plays everyone once. Organise it in the next 4 months.
Well, that's what we're saying with Al over December. We want to get, just like, if you get 4 people in the room, we say, Al, you can do it with Mark or anyone. 4 people. You can run a 4-player tournament.
Mark is someone who I'd like to get more involved, I think.
He's the funniest guy. I just...
He's dry, isn't he?
Dry as a Christmas cake.
Yeah, one of the guys in the Aldi Warhammer chat has a job in hospitality which prevents him coming to a lot of events, but is as much a contributor as anyone else, and I think actually would probably appreciate more midweek games. Actually,
yeah.
Absolutely.
The last thing that we have on our list is our sort of our honourable mentions, things that we need to sort of address. I'm going to once again plug the Shroud of St. Helens, which is taking place first weekend of February next year. There are still places available, and depending on people's army lists and things like that and how compatible they are with 4th, there may be one or two places opening up if that's the case. So just jump onto Facebook. I will share this in Fanatics in the coming weeks, particularly post 4th edition companion update, when people have the opportunity to see these list changes in more detail. Get in touch. We'd love to have you there.
So the two things that I would mention is that there's a couple of Christmas special streams coming up on my Twitch.
Ooh. As you can probably tell, I like a Christmas special stream, so tell me.
So one of them is going to be the 17th, which is obviously 4th edition release day, and it has nothing to do with Kings of War whatsoever.
It's the stand pie build-along.
No, I'm going to reveal the Christmas pudding recipe. I'm really not. I've had a 40k Warlord Titan on my desk for ages, and that's going to be the final build day stream, which is coming up soon. So that'll be, I think, somewhat interesting if you like such things. And then,
is there a time for that, or is that the sort of, is that in a one big session?
That'll be one big session.
Oh wow, so, cool. So drop in whenever you're free.
Yeah, it'll all be painted. Yeah. So it's just sticking together. So that'll be the 17th of December, and then on the 21st of December, I have a collab stream in a North versus South Christmas Orc styley with Crystal Hafley, which will be a good laugh as well. That's a Sunday, which is out of my normal routine, but yeah. Have a look up Gondas on Twitch and you will find those.
Last thing I think is Slowgrow.
Oh yeah, so Slowgrow, there's on the Mantic Discord, there's a Slowgrow not a league, a Slowgrow just paint along going on. It starts
January for 6 months.
Yeah, sounds really exciting. We're all going to be part of it, I think. I struggle to find it, but if you go to the Mantic fans Discord and scroll all the way to the bottom. There's way more channels than these in that thing. Scroll all the way to the bottom, and you have to sign up. You have to sign up.
Say yes.
But yeah, signing up says yes.
It's the last of the non-voice channel channels, essentially. It's called New Year, New Invasion.
Nice. Yeah, because you told me it was on there, and I was like, no, it's not. I've looked and it's not. And eventually I was like, oh no, there it is. So yeah, come and join in. I think it's about 20 people doing it or something. There are prizes as well. I mean, I think we're all just doing it to be like, oh, let's paint along and have some fun. But I think there are prizes. So
I've got a horrible feeling I'm going to miss like the first 2 months of that.
Well, you only have to paint one thing a month. You can paint one hero a month in a month if you want to. 30 days, paint one hero.
I think what's really lovely about it, actually, when you click on it, is it's very satisfyingly like a forum.
Yes.
Discord is, yeah.
Well, nobody, even this particular group is even sort of subdivided.
There's like threads within,
within it. So
yeah, so give that a go. Yeah, thank you for if you've stuck with us for this long, for listening. I appreciate it's been a little bit out of normal, and like normal service will be resumed with talking tactics and hobby rather than talking Christmas puddings next time, which will probably be...
I think we've been talking tactics.
Well, anyway, yeah, like this is going to be the exception, not the rule. We'll be back to more structured hour-long episodes in the maybe end of December, but if not in the new year for sure. Mm. And we always appreciate anyone, like we had a few people saying what they'd like us to talk about. We want to talk about anything, so yeah, hit us up.
So you can follow us on Facebook or interact with us on our Facebook posts in Fanatics. If you have any sort of comments or feedback that you would like to give, we'd be really, really happy to hear that, because we're still relatively new into this process. As you'll appreciate, 33% of our content so far has discussed bread sauce. It's obviously a changeable podcast format at the moment. That being said, I've been Jed.
I've been Glenn.
I've been Tom. And Glenn, what's the first rule of painting?
Oh, the first festive rule of painting is try not to wash your brush in Tia Maria over the festive season. Happy Christmas.
Bye.
Bye.